Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening this week. I'm Jared Serbu. On the program this time, our exit interview with Lieutenant General Douglas Robb, the director of the Defense Health Agency. As we go to air, he's scheduled to relinquish the directorship of DHA on November 2nd, and he'll retire from military service a few weeks later. Robb is also the first director of the Defense Health Agency. He shepherded DOD's newest combat support agency through its initial operating capability over the last 2 years before finally declaring full operating capability on October 1st of this year. We spoke a week before the DHA change of responsibility at the agency's headquarters in Falls Church, Virginia. Robb starts us off with an explanation of why DOD chose to create a shared services organization for its medical functions in the first place.
It's really a combination of several factors that all kind of, what I could say, came together over a short period of time. And that kind of drove us in the direction that we are. And let me spend a little bit of time talking about the history. There were 17 times a similar question was asked. Is there a more efficient or a more economical or a better way to deliver military health? 17 times that question was asked back to 1948. And 17 times that question was answered, but they were never able to get the support they needed to move into a more consolidated direction. So back in 2011, when we were directed to take a look at, is there a better way to deliver, or a more efficient or more economical way to deliver military health care, or a more integrated way, we were asked that question for the 18th time. You know, the stars may, I believe, were aligned for our success on looking at a more joint approach to our military healthcare enterprise. So there's the back history, and then if we look at the current events, you know, we are just coming off of you know, almost a decade of conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we had more than our share of successes in working in a joint, in an integrated manner. We were able to lay down a medical platform end-to-end from, as we say, from the injury on the battlefield all the way back through our tactical and our field hospitals, through our theater hospitals, on our medical evacuation platforms, back to what we call our Role 4 or Role 5 hospitals in Germany, back to the United States. And then on to polytrauma rehab. And so we were able to create, working together jointly, one of the most successful medical responses in what kind of what we call the continuum of care delivery. We were able, through the joint trauma system, and the operative word is the joint trauma system, create an environment where we collaborated and worked together, pre-hospital, hospital, in-route care, polytrauma rehab, to deliver the highest survivability rates in the history of recorded conflict. In other words, we say the lowest lethality rates in the history of recorded conflict. And the way that was done was looking at across the continuum of care. Instead of having pockets of excellence in silos, whether it's patient movement or hospital care in theater, hospital care back home, but folks that were leadership across the domain there in the joint trauma system that integrated that healthcare system. So we had a mindset of almost a decade of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and marine medics working side by side outside their normal boundaries or their silos of their service domains and working together, you know. And I love to tell this story. You know, if you're a young Marine down in southwest Afghanistan, all right, and all of a sudden here's a young Marine, and the first words out of his mouth if he was an engine was corpsman up, you know. You know, I need a medic, but more than likely, corpsman up. And then the person that was going to respond to him, when I call the medevac could have been Army, it could be Air Force down in that sector, or it could have been Coalition, the British. And then he'd go to a British hospital where we had U.S. Army or U.S. Navy medics working side by side with the Brits. And then they get on an Air Force C-130, which could be a guard, reserve, or active duty crew, taking them up to Bagram, which was an Air Force theater hospital, but was co-manned by the with the Army. And then you get on a strategic air medical evacuation crew, or could be, again, guard, reserve, or active duty, taking you back to Walter Reed, which actually first they would go to Launchtal. And then in Launchtal, which is an Army-commanded hospital, but you had a large Navy presence there, and you had a large Air Force presence. So as you see through this whole journey, you had this joint integration. And then, of course, you come back to the National Capital Region with the integration of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. And so that mindset, you know, you got almost a decade now of lieutenants, captains, majors, lieutenant colonels, and then you've got, again, all your enlisted corps used to working together. So if you want to talk about the timing being right, okay, for this cultural transformation, it was there. Then of course, then you look at the big picture items. The back is the fiscal constraints that were going on at the time. The fact that we've got medical is 10% of the top line of the Department of Defense. And so one of the driving factors, and again, the big pushes by the department was, hey, again, how can we become more efficient, more effective, and then deliver high-quality care at a lower cost? So you've got the financial or the fiscal drivers. You got a culture now of again, success working in a joint environment and deployed in a deployed setting, all coming together. And then now you've got this task force to look at, hey, can we do this better? Now, I'm going to be honest with you, the first couple of weeks of that, we did something I think that set us up for success. And that was asking ourselves the question, what was it, or why did the previous focus groups or task force not get to the end state that was desired? In other words, what happened that they were not successful in driving a more joint first solution for a military health system? So we spent some time on that, and I think that was key. I think that was key because it allowed us to understand, you know, where could we, make good tactical, operational, and strategic maneuvers and or decisions during this process to get buy-in. To get buy-in across the department and across the services, and I think that was one of the keys to our successes. Everybody says, hey, you know, there's. I gave you a long answer to a short question, okay? But it is. It's a long history. It was the time, the fiscal constraints, fiscal challenges, actually. That we had a moral, we had an economical imperative to address. And then we have, again, this culture of, hey, you know something? You know, we work together in a joint environment. You know, we can do some really good things. And so all that kind of came together, that kind of culminated in our ability to give some recommendations to the Deputy Secretary of Defense, of which the recommendation was to stand up a defense health agency, which was shared services, or joint first solution where it makes sense, and that recommendation was accepted by the department, and then again by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the services.
So it seems to me one of the huge dangers when you're setting up really any new organization is that you're just creating a new layer of management and bureaucracy, slowing things down and adding cost instead of, you know, basically the opposite of what you're saying you're trying to do. How do you make sure that you don't do that and you actually bring efficiency to the table and add value to the system?
All right, that question is spot on. And I'll answer this in kind of a couple of different ways. First off, the going in point on this was there will be no growth. There will be no growth. And you're right. You know, sometimes you create an enterprise, an entity, and there's growth.
Certainly not in the Pentagon.
Not in the Pentagon. And so for every, and I think this is important. And I think, let's go back to 1 October 2013. So when we stood up the Defense Health Agency, folks may remember what was going on at the time. We were in the middle of sequestration. You know, I'm handed the flag, and they said, "Welcome to the Defense Health Agency." And oh, by the way, a very significant portion of your organization is currently on furlough. And so when you think about that, you know, we stood up in an austere and lean times, and I think that set the mentality that allowed us to lead by example. And I still remember, you know, some of my directors coming to me and say, "Hey, Doc, you know, I need money for capital investment. You know, I need money to do this and do that." And I look him in the eye, and this was interesting because I know what the directors were saying. So, you know, this wouldn't happen to me in my service, you know. But they came and say, I need this money. And I go, there is no money. Go find the money. And you know what? That psychological impact of when we stood up, I think, helped shape this organization. And you know what? They found the money. They figured it out. You know how they did it? They did it by savings early, okay, and then shifting that for capital investment. The way we did this, which is, again, not the way we're used to working in the military. So I've got six directorates, and I got 10 shared services. Some folks needed money for capital investment. Some people were saving money early, and that's exactly what we did. We basically, and I can't remember where this has ever happened in my military leadership history, we paid our own way the first year, and that's rare. We actually paid our own way the first year, and it was one team, you know, one fight, working together. So there's the environment that we stood up in. So for every individual that's in the Defense Health Agency, that was an individual from the services. So there was no growth. Of course, some of our savings, again, over time, will be, you know, if you consolidate health information and technology, we're running three parallel health information and technology operations, okay? I mean, this is standard business model practice. You consolidate, there ought to be, and there will be. In fact, we're already showing savings, not only in, again, contracts, that's huge, okay? But then also in personal savings, you know? So you had five working this and five working that and 10 working this, you add them all together, you know, it shouldn't take 20. It ought to probably take, 15 or 18, I don't know. But so now the other thing that I think is key is you talk about another layer of bureaucracy. The Defense Health Agency is not a headquarters. The Defense Health Agency is what I call its function. Okay, our job is to deliver shared services, deliver capability, to deliver opportunity to the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps medical forces. And so much like Defense Logistics Agency is to the logistic world or the FOR community, much like DISA, Defense Information Systems Agency, is to the six or the communications world, much like Defense Intelligence Agency is to the two or the intelligence world. So we're an enabler. In other words, we're the joint force solution that provides a capability or service back to the services. And so when folks say, you know, those are your health information and technology people, I go, no, they're not. That's your health information and technology capability. That belongs to you, Army, Navy, Air Force, because the only difference is in the old paradigm, you had all Army folks running your health information. You had all Navy. Now what you have is you got an Army, Navy, and Air Force sitting side by side, okay, and you're getting a more integrated and hopefully a better product. And so, and then when you think about the investment, let's just look at the leadership, you know, those general officers, okay, and those SESs that are sitting at our directorate levels, okay, those weren't new general officers. Those came from the services. So there was no plus up in the Army, Navy, or Air Force Medical Corps services. So that when you think about, you know, at that senior level, that's an investment. So you're going to put some of your best and brightest over here because the intent is for you to deliver back to your service, and then now, oh, by the way, back to the other sister services, okay? People say, what does the Defense Health Agency do? You know, the Defense Health Agency enables the service surgeon generals to provide medically ready and ready medical forces to their respective service chiefs and the combatant commanders. That's what we do. Just like Defense Logistics Agency does, just like DISA does, just like DIA does.
That's Lieutenant General Douglas Robb, the director of the Defense Health Agency. He's with us for the full hour this week, and we'll come back and talk more after a short break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DoD. Getting back to our exit interview with Lieutenant General Douglas Robb, the outgoing director of the Defense Health Agency. DHA just declared full operational capability as part of its mission to make DOD's medical functions more efficient and effective. The agency was tasked with wringing $3.5 billion out of the department's health budget between 2015 and 2019 by moving DOD to a more efficient system of 10 shared services, from health IT to contracting to facility construction. So far, it's already found at $236 million in efficiencies in its first year.
To get to those savings that you were talking about, you know, the military department's health organizations have to stop doing some stuff and actually use the shared services that you're providing. You talked about buy-in. How do you get that? Because you can't go ordering around the surgeons general who have just as many stars on their shoulders as you do. So it's got to be voluntary and collaborative, right? How do you do that?
Well, I think there's a multifactorial answer to that also. If you haven't, you're seeing a theme here. There's no one answer to any of these questions you have. I think at the core of that question, or what I would call the fabric of the organization, we made a calculated, decision early on. You know, there's a couple different ways we could have presented an organizational construct back to the services. You know, one way, and which ultimately usually fails, is that you get a couple of folks that sit in a closet, you know, sketch something up, you know, and then try to jam it down, you know, somebody's throat. You know, that fails. You know, it may be the right answer, but it's you're not going to get the buy-in. The other way to do it is that you allow the folks that are going to benefit, is that they're part of the process in helping shape what that organization is going to look like. When you look at the task force that looked at, you know, what are the courses of action, you know, what are the organizational constructs that could deliver a more joint first solution where it makes sense, I think one of the early decisions that we made was the composition of that task force. You know, there's a lot of people when you're talking about an organizational change of this magnitude that have skin in the game, that have an opportunity to say no. Okay, so let's go back to what we said. Why were they not successful in the past? It's because I believe it's because we weren't inclusive in allowing the folks that had an opportunity to say no in our bureaucratic system. And so we made a conscious decision, you know, in which then of course it takes a little longer, but if it takes a little bit longer, but you arrive at a relative consensus, then you're actually going to get to the end state a whole lot faster. And so when you looked at the task force makeup, it was a larger group where we had, as you can imagine, we had senior officers, general officers from the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines. We also included CAPE, you know, the folks that are responsible for, you know, the organizational construct, you know. And so, you know, if you're going to build an organization, it would be nice to have the folks that say you can or cannot do it that way instead of them telling you at the end. We had a senior representation from Comptroller. As you can imagine, Comptroller had a huge, you know, dog in this fight. And that helped shape, you know, us understand how, you know, where money can be saved, where money can't be saved, or how the savings are taken. That was huge. That was huge. And guess what? Guess who one of our biggest advocates was when we were all done with this was the comptroller. Because they said, you know what? These guys have a vision. They had a process. They have and they were transparent, and they have a repeatable process. And so we also had, at the end of the day, you know, we are a combat support agency now, but at the time we didn't know that. But medical is an enabler to the line. We had senior line, we had general officer line leadership on the task force that was going to determine what the future of military medicine may look like. Okay, we also had senior representation from OSD services, family readiness, you know, the commissary. But that's a customer service oriented organization. And so they gave us a different perspective. And it was very healthy. It was very healthy. So, and then, of course, we had the joint staff. At the time, I was the joint staff surgeon. And then you had OSD represented by FHP&R, then Dr. Taylor. So you can see that group was – so a lot of the folks that were on that group – and then we also had – I'll be honest with you, They weren't a voting member, but they were sitting right there, you know, right over our shoulder. We had the GAO. They're the ones that are going to scrutinize what we do. So we said, we got to bring them in. So that was key. So you bring all that together. But what we did also, while we built this thing, again, remember who could say no? At the end of the day, when you looked at the other ones, sometimes it was one of the services in the past that said no. Sometimes it was somebody on OSD said no. So what we did while we did this would end up being a 180-day task force, is we got vector checks. We got rudder checks along the way. Even before we had come to...
Before it was time to sit down and write recommendations.
We even had courses of action, here's what we're thinking. So and just to let you know, from a historical perspective, this 180-day task force actually crossed the domains of two chairmen. So we actually had to get the buy-in, not from one, but from two chairmen. We also turned the DepSecDef, okay, who, by the way, chartered this, okay? And so I think that was probably not by design, but I think gave the validity for the decision for the course of action. So it's not like, oh, that was just an agenda item of somebody. No, it wasn't. It was several senior leaders and their staffs coming to the same conclusion.
Yeah.
And so when you think about top cover.
Pretty good.
Pretty dang good. You know, you think about the folks that were working those. Again, not everybody agreed on that task force, but the question was, can you live with this? All right. It was the recommendation for the Defense Health Agency was, again, it was pretty significant as far as the voting. And then the next step, you're talking about getting cultural buy-in, service buy-in. The Defense Health Agency was built by the services, for the services. And that I think that was key. And so when we look at the 10 lines of effort where we said there was opportunity for savings, for more efficiencies, for more effectiveness, okay? So let's just take logistics, for example, or we'll use contracting, or we'll use... It was the subject matter experts from the services who did the business case analysis and the business process engineering, re-engineering, for the three or four lines of effort where we thought there was opportunity.
In other words, this whole process on the front end where you're deciding what makes sense for DHA to do versus the services continuing to do.
Right. And so it was built by the services. So in other words, the logistics community, you know, came together. You know, that doesn't mean they all agreed, but they came together and said, here's where the opportunity is. And what was also key, again, to withstand the scrutiny of those, you know, that would then come back and want to check our homework, so to speak, okay, was that, again, we used a GAO-led process, but also was that each of the shared services, each of the business case analysis, business process reengineering, were done exactly the same way with a reproducible and transparent methodology.
Lieutenant General Douglas Robb is the director of the Defense Health Agency. We'll talk more about DHA's stand-up over the last 2 years after another quick break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Thanks for listening to On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Our guest this week is Lieutenant General Douglas Robb, the outgoing director of the Defense Health Agency. He's scheduled to retire within the next few weeks. We're talking about what it took over the last 2 years to successfully stand up DoD's newest combat support agency and centralize a lot of its healthcare management functions. Before the break, he told us the study panel that led to DHA's creation in 2013 also helped develop a new governance model for the entire military health system and sprouted new communities of interest from across the military services.
The personnel community coalesced and they created, that group. And then the budget guys kind of coalesced and they said, hey, but ultimately we ran this through the deputy surgeon generals. Again, over time, the ops guys say, hey, you know, you're getting into our business. You know, you need to run it through the 3-5 guys. Okay. And then the same thing happened with the money guys. Hey, you're talking about common cost accounting. You're talking about a single pharmacy checkbook. Well, you need to run that through us first. So you watch these communities of interest come together. You're talking about all these folks moving into the Defense Health Agency and Health Information and Technology, or you're talking about in our multi-service markets, that you can shift resources left or right, you know, to meet the demand signal. Now you're in our business. So they got together. So that was good. So you're basically, you're creating almost a pseudo joint staff here. Mm-hmm. Then that fed the medical, what we call the medical deputies action group, that's what the deputy surgeon generals. And then it was presented to the surgeon generals. So you had this whole governance process, again, a reproducible, transparent, above the board building of this thing called the Defense Health Agency. To go back to your original question, you're right. Nowhere in there did you see the word command and control, did you? We kind of coined kind of an expression. You don't need unity of command to do the right thing. It's unity of effort. And so in reality, having come off the joint staff as a joint staff surgeon, you know, our military is run, okay, when we execute on the battlefield, of course, it's unity of command. But when you talk about it with the chairman in a way that, you know, that's unity of effort. You know, that takes a different kind of leadership. If you have a common goal, you know, at the end of the day, it's focus on the patient, focus on the patient, focus on the patient, like we did in the battlefield. You drop your silos, you drop your service, you know, prerogatives, and you focus on the patient, okay? Everything else falls in place. And so that whole mindset, I think you're seeing in the logistics community, you're seeing in the contracting community, you're seeing in the facilities community. It's all coming together. It's not easy. Folks are used to autonomy, you know, you feel like you have to give something up, but good leaders, you know, strategic leaders realize, you know, sometimes you have to give something up to get something, you know, and let's go back again. There's so many layers here, but when you look at the fiscal constraints, you know, the fiscal challenges that we are facing today, our leaders, our medical leaders understand that in order for them to provide the breadth and the depth of the medical capabilities to support their service chiefs and the combatant commanders, and realizing we're, you know, to include our TRICARE health plan, we're 10% of the top line. Right. We have to do something different. 75-80% of what we do is the same across all three services, and you put what I call that 20 or 25% operational spin for your service. Okay, but there are much like it's when you think about it from the business perspective. That's exactly what healthcare is doing today when you watch how all these major corporations are working. So it makes sense. And our leadership realizes that that's where the buy-in is, because the challenges are there. But then the buy-in is also because we created a joint healthcare organizational construct built by the services for the services, so that you know, that before those folks were in their service, so that those HIT or those contractors or those logisticians or those researchers were the same high quality professional folks that were delivering, you know, that particular domain back to their service, you know, the Army to the Army, the Navy to the Navy, the Air Force. But guess what? You know, they're still those same professionals. Nothing's changed, except for now they're sitting side by side with an equal professional from the Army, and so the mentality is changing a little bit on how we deliver these, and so again, it's not easy. You know, that whole organizational change management, you know, that cultural change management, but again, I think we set ourselves up, as I've explained, for success by many of the early things that we did in the beginning to help get that cultural buy-in.
I want to talk a little bit about nuts and bolts of what DHA actually does, in particular the transition to full operational capability. In that vein, what are you able to do today that you weren't doing, say, 6 months ago? What does FOC actually mean for that purpose?
Okay. So if we go back and again look at the original business case analysis and business process reengineering, and then we put about $3.5 billion on the table. Where we said that we believe we can achieve or realize those savings by, again, through the business process reengineering and the business case analysis. I mean, business case analysis, business process reengineering across the domains and doing the joint first solution where it makes sense. Now, we will realize those savings because those savings were already taken out of the next 5 years budget. so that's a good thing. That forces us to deliver it, and we will. And so what you're seeing is that folks are already realizing, I don't want to say the pressure's on, but yes it is. And so, you know what, it's funny how you sit there and you say, you may have, you know, say, well, I'm not, well, you know, you got to be ready for this now, because if you don't do that, in the joint environment, you know, that, you know, then you know you could either degrade your services capability or even more importantly degrade the enterprise's capability. And so I believe, you know, that you're already seeing that across the board. I tell you what's exciting. We have six multi-service markets where two or more of the services deliver healthcare together. One is Pacific Northwest. We have San Antonio. We have the Portsmouth, Virginia area, Colorado Springs, Hawaii, the National Capital Region. And so we have these six multi-service markets. In the old paradigm, each of the services would do a business plan based on, you know, say if you're down in the Portsmouth, Virginia area, Portsmouth Naval Hospital would do a business plan and put it up through the Navy chain. And Langley Air Force Base would put it up through their hospital, through their medical chain. And then Fort Eustis, okay? But what they do now is they create, and this is all part of the Defense Health Agency support, they now put together a market business plan. So when you think about that, it's how do we best use all the three services to deliver the most effective and efficient healthcare in that region. National Capital Region is a great example also. So if you're a surgeon now not at Walter Reed, but if you're a surgeon, orthopedic surgeon over at Malcolm Grove Medical Center, which is the Air Force's, you got to look at your schedule now. Because in the old paradigm, you were doing surgeries at Malcolm Grove. Now you may be doing surgeries up at Fort Meade. You may be doing them over at Walter Reed, or you may be doing them at Fort Belvoir. Because what we're doing now is we're using, just like a civilian healthcare organization would do, you would sit there and use your resources to go to where the demand signal is. Now, that's the business model. So now I'm going to maximize, again, your output. But what's more important than the business model is the readiness model. Because the more you do, the more cases you do, the more procedures you do, the more healthcare you deliver, the higher is your currency and your competency for you to do that contingency. So I often say, does the business model drive the readiness model in the new paradigm, or does the readiness model drive the business model? And the answer is yes. Yes, it does.
It can be mutually reinforcing.
Exactly. So you go into a multi. So what we did before was, you know, you were competing against the other services for Milcon dollars. So now what we're doing is our facilities folks from the Defense Health Agency, Army, Navy, and Air Force folks, okay, are going into each of those markets now. And what they're doing is say, what if I have this, you know, what are the priorities, not for the Army medicine or Navy medicine or Air Force medicine, what are the priorities? What if I could only build one more thing in the market, what should I build? Before it was the Army was competing for this and the Navy was competing for that or the Air Force. Now, what will help maximize the delivery, the business delivery, which then in the end of the day will enhance the readiness platforms. And so that's fun to watch. Logistics. You're going into a market now. Think about this. You know, you got your big recapitalization. Like, let's use radiology equipment. Why not go in and then do a recapitalization plan for all of radiology across that market, which is what again, major healthcare corporations do out there. And then you take that and now you go back, and now we can get a better deal, because it's about the more you buy, the better price you get. And so now you get all three services deciding, here's my recapitalization plan. You got the Defense Health Agency logistics folks driving that. And now we go to Defense Logistics Agency, okay? And now we have a long-term consolidated, you know, big ticket buy items, and now it's incredible the prices that they can get for us. And I just kind of touched on something. One of the second or third order effects of this Defense Health Agency and this what we call military health system reorganization is, guess who my new best friends, our new best friends are, or the other agencies. So when you think about Defense Logistics Agency, before, their job is to get the best deal for the government, okay? So they were having to go to Army medicine, Navy medicine, okay, Air Force medicine, okay? Now there's a single point, not for everything, but for about 80% of the core.
Sure.
Now there's a single point of contact. So can you imagine the potential? Same thing with DISA. Defense information. Can you imagine? So especially with this acquisition of this new electronic health record, which we could spend the next hour talking about, but can you imagine us trying to roll that out if they were having to negotiate Army, Navy, and Air Force medicine, three separate domains for the rollout of this? So now they've got a single point of contact. We just made their job easier. So we make them look good. They make us look good. Okay. Again, our capability is enhanced, of course, and then of course the taxpayers' dollars, of course, are actually saved. And so it's you know, we could go on and on and on. I mean, this is just today. This is just in the first year or year and a half now of us being able to again affect change, and it's exciting to see how the communities of practice in each one of these shared services domains have come together and then working with our, again, what I call our sister agencies. Again, I'm going to, we could talk about health and human service. We could just go down the whole thing. Talking about the VA, now we're a single voice for the VA in many areas where before we weren't. And so it's exciting. It's exciting to see this soon. You know, there's a lot of work to be done. Folks ask me, are you, again, as I come up here, again, at the end of my career now and having stood up this Defense Health Agency and having been part of the task force that helped create this military health system governance reform way ahead, folks ask me, are you happy? And I say, we are a whole lot further along than I ever imagined. But of course, not as far as long as I would hope us or where we could be. And so there's a lot of challenges ahead of us. But I believe we have the leadership in place. We have the buy-in in place. I believe we have the strategic imperative to do what we're doing and to continue to do what we do. And again, I see nothing but, again, enhanced capabilities. It's like when I talked to one of the combatant commanders one time, and I explained to him, we will be to medical, okay, the Defense Health Agency, as DLA is, Defense Logistics Agency is to the logistics world. And that combatant commander says, well, I can't go to war without DLA today. And I says, precisely. That's our vision. That's our vision.
That's Lieutenant General Douglas Robb, who is soon to retire as the first director of the Defense Health Agency. He'll join us for one final segment after one more break this hour. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Back on federalnewsradio.com at 1500 AM, this is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. A few minutes left with Lieutenant General Douglas Robb, the director of the Defense Health Agency, as we discuss the agency's recent declaration of full operational capability and what it took to create that new agency over the last 2 years. Robb says it was only possible by getting the buy-in of the military services surgeons general and building the new organization as a collaborative process.
I know you got to run in about 2 minutes, but let me just finish up on your unity of effort point, because that's not something you can legislate or mandate by policy. As you transition out of office and into civilian life and hand the reins to your successor, how do you make sure that's sustained over time, that inclusive spirit that built the agency stays around, and that people don't go splinter off back mm-hmm. into their military departments again down the road? Because there's nothing holding them together necessarily other than willingness to work together.
Well, I the answer is there is something holding them together, and that's unity of mission, and again, I go back to focus on the patient. And whether that's in peacetime in garrison or whether that's, on the battlefield in Afghanistan or wherever we are asked to go into harm's way. I think we are building a culture. I think we have laid an incredible foundation for that, what I call joint first solution, where it makes sense. They always say that one of the most important things you do is, you groom your successors. There is no shortage of what I will call like-minded senior leaders. My successor, Admiral Bono, who again has been part of the joint world now. She was PACOM surgeon, Pacific Command surgeon, and then came here and has been the National Capital Region Medical Director. And so she understands the power of working together. She understands what unity of effort. In other words, when we talk about these multi-service markets, there's no command and control here. It's just doing the right thing. And it's amazing, if you let the folks do it, they'll do the right thing. And sometimes the leaders have to get out of the way, actually. And most of these things are grassroots driven. These are coming from the ground up. Every once in a while, of course, we got to say, hey, guys, this is where we need to go. But there is no shortage of folks out there. Again, I keep going back to the 10 years of conflict. We got a generation plus or more of folks who, you know, you walk into a Walter Reed, or you know you walk into a San Antonio Military Medical Center, you know, and you know you've got Army Air Force uniforms working side by side. They don't know any different nowadays. This generation doesn't, you know. And the same thing up here at Walter Reed, I think the transformation is there. We have to stay true to the governance process. All right, I've been remiss, but we would not be here today. We would not be here today without the incredible senior leadership from Dr. Whitson, okay, and his principal deputy. He's a undersecretary for health affairs, and then we've got his principal deputy, Dr. Karen Geis. They get it, you know. This is one of those things when you look at, you know, how do the stars align, you know, and you look at opportunity. We would not be here today had we not had those two, again, dedicated professional senior leaders, you know, what I call, you know, on deck. When these, transformations occurred. And so, from the OSD level down through PNR into health affairs, from the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff down to the service chiefs, down into the service surgeon generals, you know, getting, as we talked about, I'm going to go back to the very beginning of this discussion, how we got them all understanding where we need to go and why we need to go there, and then ultimately how we're going to get there, okay? But at the end of the day, you got to have a couple skippers that are driving the ship, you know, and it's been, again, it's been key to have Dr. Woodson and Dr. Geis, all right, helping shepherd the creation and stand up of this, again, with the service surgeon generals, the deputy surgeon generals, and then just working our way down into the communities of practice and the community of interest in the services.
General, thanks for giving us so much time. Wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
Lieutenant General Douglas Robb is the director of the Defense Health Agency. We spoke at DHA's headquarters in Falls Church, Virginia, just a few days before he was scheduled to relinquish that leadership post after having led the organization through its formation over the last 2 years. If you missed any of our conversation, we will post the full hour, as always, at federalnewsradio.com. That's going to do it for this week's show. Thanks, as always, for listening to On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. So long.
You've been listening to On DOD with Federal News Radio DOD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DOD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.